Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
What happens when there is $600 billion extra dollars out there begging to be spent in the economy? Lesson 3,426, that you have to watch what you say on Facebook. And one for the office water cooler today, middle managers actually do matter. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation Defender, monitoring, protecting, and helping improve your online reputation while deleting personal data from websites that sell it. ReputationDefender.com. And by the Wall Street Journal Weekend, offering four sections of ideas and information, available at newsstands every Saturday.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is the 9th of November today. Good to have you with us. And we will get underway on this Tuesday with an observation and a question, all rolled into one. A dollar is a dollar is a dollar, right? Where any given dollar bill goes once it gets into circulation doesn't much matter because it's all just money. Fungibility is the technical term, and that's true as far as it goes. But now that there are $600 billion extra dollars in circulation, thanks to the Federal Reserve's announcement last week, there are some worries that all that cheap money is going to end up in all the wrong places. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner reports.
The idea behind that $600 billion infusion is to inspire consumers to spend, banks to lend, and corporations to invest, investment that will ideally lead to jobs. But yesterday, Dallas Fed President Richard Fisher warned that Ben Bernanke's move was risky business. He said all that cheap money could stoke inflation and encourage speculation instead of hiring. Stephen Platt is a futures strategist for Archer Financial Services.
The Fed cannot really corral these dollars and push them into just the housing market or to support employment in this country.
Instead, Platt says, all that extra cash could flow outside the U.S. or into commodities like gold or silver, and that appears to be happening.
Silver prices have added a couple bucks. The sugar market has also added a couple dollars, and coffee prices have moved from just under $2 to around $2.15 in a matter of a couple days.
Gold and oil prices have shot up, too. UBS economist Drew Mattis says gasoline has jumped 10% since the Fed's move, not exactly an economy booster. Mattis says the Fed is betting that the benefits of cheaper money will outweigh any negative effects from higher commodity prices, but the risk is yet more bubbles.
And so what a lot of economists, including some people in the Federal Reserve, are concerned about is that they're simply encouraging excessive risk-taking again, and that that'll effectively lead us down the same path that might have caused the housing bubble to begin with.
All this angst over U.S. monetary policy arrives just in time for this Thursday's G20 World Economic Summit. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Speaking of which, the president's Asian trade mission hit Indonesia today. He will be in South Korea, as Sarah said, in a couple of days for the G20 meeting. Trade is top of mind for pretty much everybody, as we told you yesterday. This thing called global rebalancing is the economic buzzword du jour, evening out which countries buy a lot of stuff and which countries sell a lot of stuff so that everybody can grow a little bit. Earlier today, President Obama said flat out the world needs to address global imbalances, a polite way of saying American consumers can't do it all anymore, and that he wants other countries to buy American. We asked Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith what exactly the president wants to sell more of.
President Obama is hoping we can cut our trade deficit and create jobs by ramping up our exports. Michael Sincota is a trade expert at Georgetown University.
Right now, our key export is airplanes, and that's sort of mainly the Boeing account, if you want to call it that.
But Sincota says we're probably not going to see a lot of growth in demand for big-ticket items like planes. Instead, we have to look to the countries that are growing, says economist Derek Scissors with the Heritage Foundation.
Right now, the growth is in Asia, and what Asia actually needs most of is commodities and technology.
Commodities like soybeans and wheat, which developing countries are buying as feed for livestock as their diets shift to include more meat. but it takes a lot of soybeans to equal a 747. So if we really want to ramp up exports or double them, as the president has said, that's not going to cut it, says Georgetown Sinkota.
We'd certainly have to look at new export areas.
Like cars, manufactured goods, and expertise such as financial consulting. Former Undersecretary of Commerce Robert Shapiro says for higher-end goods and services,
we would also look to fast-growing advanced economies.
Shapiro says a cheaper dollar will help, but increasing high-end exports will mean marketing efforts that will take time. Economist Derek Scissors agrees.
It doesn't look like we're going to get a rapid increase in exports. We'll get a slow increase over the next couple of years.
Scissors says even a small increase in exports will help create jobs and spur growth. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Here's today's Man Bites Dog story, domestic policy on this one. Even as some of the Republicans who were elected to Congress earlier this month make noises about repealing the health care overhaul, one major health insurance company said today that would be a bad idea. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genza reports.
Cigna CEO David Cordani explained his opposition to repeal at a healthcare summit in New York. He said insurers have spent, quote, over a year of sweat equity on formation of the healthcare law. They've also started to implement it. Vivian Ho is a healthcare economist at Rice University. She says insurers have already put a lot of energy into designing plans for the law's new health insurance exchanges.
To sort of see all that just get thrown away and to have to start all over again, that's a waste of resources to these private insurance companies.
Insurers say they would also be hurt if certain parts of the law were overturned. Take the requirement that almost everyone buy insurance. Robert Zirkelbach is a spokesman for the insurance trade group America's Health Insurance Plans. He says without that mandate, only sick people would buy coverage. They wouldn't be balanced out by healthy people in the insurance pool.
What happens is there becomes an incentive for people to wait until after they get sick to purchase insurance.
But health insurers do want some changes to the law. Zirkelbach doesn't like limits on how much premiums can vary based on the policyholder's age. Wendell Potter used to be a spokesman for Cigna. Now he's a consumer advocate. He says those restrictions should remain.
Before reform, insurance companies charge folks who are in their 50s or getting close to retirement age up to 10 times as much as younger people.
Potter says more and more people in that age bracket are uninsured. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Traders on Wall Street made a late-day charge but couldn't quite break even. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Social media has been around long enough now that just about every good-sized company has rules about what employees can and can't do on Facebook and Twitter and all the rest of them. And that brings us to today's cautionary tale. The National Labor Relations Board has issued a complaint against a company in Connecticut for firing a woman over comments that she posted about her boss on her Facebook page. Marketplace's Janet Babin explains.
The complaint alleges that American Medical Response of Connecticut violated the National Labor Relations Act. That act protects workers' rights to discuss their employment amongst themselves, whether they're unionized or not. Leif Solomon says that's what this AMR employee was trying to do when she was fired. He's acting general counsel for the National Labor Relations Board.
The only thing different here is where the discussion took place. It took place at Facebook instead of at the water cooler.
The complaint also alleges that the company's Facebook policy was prohibitively broad. Attorney John Barr represents AMR. He disputes that charge.
It's never been applied to deny employees the right that they do have to engage in concerted activities and discussions about conditions of employment or wages.
Attorney Mary Lee Abrams counsels companies on social media policies. She compares what this employee did to standing on a street corner dissing your boss.
The National Labor Relations Board, it appears to me that they are trying to micromanage what's happening out there.
But law professor William McGeverin at the University of Minnesota Law School says Facebook's not exactly a street corner.
Facebook is a tool for social networking. And the people you're speaking to is not just the general public. It's going to be people you've created friendships with.
Until the case is decided next year, many lawyers are advising companies to re-examine their Facebook policies. In New York, I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Let's take a quick second here and do a little word association, all right? If I say bus, you say what? Slow, crowded, late, all of the above? Buses don't necessarily have the best reputation, but a new kind of bus line is popping up across the country. Bus Rapid Transit. Dedicated lanes separated from the rest of the traffic flow, all in the name of providing the speed and comfort of a rail just with rubber tires on regular pavement. From the public radio collaboration Changing Gears, Dan Bobkoff continues our series now on the future of transportation.
Enrique Penalosa is about to take his first ride on Cleveland's bus rapid transit.
The bus comes this way, or it goes that way.
The station's in the middle of a major thoroughfare called Euclid Avenue. Penalosa is paying attention to all the details.
Exclusive lanes.
Buses have their own lanes and special traffic lights to speed through intersections.
Prepaid stations, prepaid boarding.
You buy your ticket at the station, so you don't have to wait in line as people fumble for change. And the platform is at the same height as the bus, so you can walk right on. It even sounds like a train.
And the whole thing looks like it has been done with care and love.
That's a real compliment. See, Enrique Penalosa is kind of the guru of bus rapid transit these days. A decade ago, he was mayor of Bogota, Colombia. The buses then were congested and unorganized.
Complete chaos, traffic jams.
And virtually overnight, his administration built what many consider the gold standard of bus rapid transit.
Yes, we did it from zero, from scratch to operation, in just 3 years.
Just 3 years. Think about that for a moment. In one term as mayor, Penalosa managed to plan, build, and open a public transit system that moves 1.7 million people a day. That's been impressing transit officials in the U.S., too. They face shrinking budgets for their grand plans. That's why Los Angeles, Kansas City, and Eugene, Oregon have recently launched bus rapid transit. And Joe Calabrese of the Greater Cleveland Regional Transit Authority says it worked there, too.
We spent about $200 million. If it was rail, it would have cost about $800 million.
Cleveland's route is called the Healthline. It's a 9-mile connection between downtown and a neighborhood with major hospitals and the city's cultural center. The construction devastated many businesses along the line, but since it opened 2 years ago, development is picking up. Estimates peg more than $4 billion in investment, at least in part spurred by the buses.
I have been to Cleveland 3 times, and I've been to a couple of the others. And Cleveland and the Euclid Avenue corridor, we can all learn a lot from what they've done there. It's truly impressive.
Steve Bland runs the Port Authority of Allegheny County. That's the transit agency for the Pittsburgh area. That city also has a university and hospital center disconnected from its downtown, and the hope is bus rapid transit could link the two and help the struggling neighborhood in between.
Here we are in the uptown area. You can see...
Uptown is that struggling neighborhood. I'm on a bus with David Wolwill in Pittsburgh. He does planning for the Port Authority.
So this is really a community that could go either way.
Yeah, and I'm very optimistic that it's going to go forward, in part because of the very high level of transit service.
But John Norquist of the Congress for the New Urbanism says that while cash-strapped transit agencies love cheap bus rapid transit, there's a perception problem.
Americans think of it as, you know, Greyhound and Trailways, and if you can't afford to ride on the train or you can't afford to buy a car, then you ride on Greyhound. So it's kind of stigmatized.
The stigma against buses is so bad that when Joe Calabrese of Cleveland's transit agency talks about the Healthline, he doesn't even use the B word.
We don't call them buses. We call them rapid transit vehicles.
Catchy, right? Jim Anderson, riding the Healthline one morning, wasn't impressed with bus rapid transit.
Added trees and flowers still gets me from A to B.
You can't please everyone, but overall, the Healthline seems to be working. The transit authority's Joe Calabrese says ridership is up 56% over the old, traditional bus route. In Cleveland, I'm Dan Bobkoff for Marketplace.
Take a peek at what bus rapid transit looks like, how those dedicated lanes work with regular traffic, and you can hear other stories in our Future of Transportation series as well. It's at our website, marketplace.org. Coming up.
It's about the citizen having control. It's about getting them involved in their community. It's about taking responsibility for their community.
It's about Britain's big society, actually. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials dropped 60 points on this Tuesday, about 0.5%, ended things at 11,346. The NASDAQ down 17 points, 0.2%, 2562 at the bell. The S&P 500 fell 9 points, 0.8%, 1213 is the number you're looking for. Financials had another downer day. Citigroup and Morgan Stanley unloaded more than 3%. Bank of America lost 2.5% today. In energy stocks, Chevron had one of the worst days on the Dow, draining 1.5%, but ExxonMobil pumped up 1% today. General Electric said it's going to invest $2 billion in China over the next couple of years, working with state-owned businesses there, but GE stock still dipped about 0.5%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.66%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. By CSX, working to reduce traffic and pollution while moving 1 million tons of freight daily. CSX, how tomorrow moves. And by Vanguard, whose mission is to simplify investing and to help people reach their financial goals at vanguard.com/public radio. Every day, be sure to wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report. It's 8 minutes of radio you can't afford to miss. You'll hear updates on all the latest developments in business and finance as they happen.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at the events for Wednesday. The president travels from Indonesia to South Korea. He stops in Seoul to attend the G20 meeting. At the Center for American Progress, panelists discuss the future of the U.S.-Turkey relationship. And actor Jeff Bridges kicks off an effort to end childhood hunger in America by 2015. He is the spokesman for Share Our Strengths, No Kid Hungry campaign. I'm Megan Larson.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There is perhaps no group in corporate America as beleaguered as the middle managers. So easy to make fun of. Think Steve Carell as Michael Scott in The Office on television. And so easily dismissed as ineffective. Think of how often middle managers take the hit around your office. You'll know what I mean. But this is one of those times when the conventional wisdom is just wrong. And Stanford University economist Nicholas Bloom can prove it. Nick, it's good to have you with us.
Hi there.
Seems a fairly straightforward question. Does middle management matter? I suppose anybody who's worked in an office has their own opinion, but how do you go figuring it out quantitatively?
It is a great question. middle managers have long been derided in some kind of Dilbert-esque world as paper pushers. So we took up the challenge by actually going out to India, where management practices, as you can probably guess, are not fantastic, and running an experiment with a large number of Indian firms. And what we did is we randomly selected the firms. For some of them, got a lot of free consulting to improve their management practices and left the others as they were. And stunningly, we find massive improvements in performance in the ones that had empowered middle managers.
So you found these factories in various states of managerial disarray. What was going on the ground?
When you turn up, the place is in chaos. I mean, there's yarn lying around all over the place, machines left broken. One of the times I was there, I discovered there was a machine that was, when it was producing the fabric, was making holes in it by mistake. And you'd be taken through into a room next door and you discover a guy fixing all the holes. And of course, the obvious question is, you know, why didn't they fix the machine? And the guy fixing the holes doesn't want to do anything about it because his job is to fix holes. And the factory manager doesn't have the power to change things. So it was just some kind of depressing world of, you know, mistakes would happen time after time and they'd never get fixed.
So I imagine you went in with a checklist of managerial things like maintenance and regular production meetings and that kind of thing. I mean, how did it work?
the way it worked is we went in trying to get them to adopt the types of management practices that are now very common in the US, Europe, and Japan. And interestingly, those practices are focused very much on getting inventory down, so there's no point holding lots of stock because it's expensive to have it, and also focusing on quality. For example, if you find a defect in your product, so they make fabric, so that would be stains, to try and work out immediately why it is and make sure it doesn't happen again.
And so what happened at the end of your experiment? You gave them these consulting tips and you gave them training. What did it look like 6 months later?
We took a bunch of before and after photos, those ones you see in the magazines for hair loss or weight loss. And they're very powerful. I mean, you look beforehand and the place is in chaos, garbage everywhere, a complete mess. And the after looks like a standard, you know, humming factory. And of course, the performance and the profitability of these firms went up immensely.
You being an academic, I imagine you have some sympathy for this argument that really what we need is more business schools, right, to teach middle managers how to do this stuff.
You know, I teach in Stanford Business School, so putting my colors on the line, I'm clearly prejudiced. What I think they need out in India is less, though, the kind of elite two-year Stanford or Harvard or whatever MBA. They need much more three-month training.
Is there hope? I mean, will this ethos of middle management take over in developing economies, do you think?
The future for India, it's definitely going to be better middle management, better management practices, because as wages go up, they need to be more productive to survive. If you're paying somebody $5 a day, as they are in India now, you don't have to be well managed. But if you're paying them $50 a day, you really better be damn good. And so that's what's driving improvements in management practices, is the need to compete.
Nicholas Bloom, he's a professor of economics at Stanford University, the author of a recent study with the World Bank of the efficiencies and importance, and it turns out they are important, of middle managers. Nick, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Nick sent us some of those before and after pictures he took while he was over in India. They're on our website. It's marketplace.org. Those who want to shrink the size of government have spoken, and I'm not talking about the midterm elections here. The new British government just announced the deepest spending cuts in a generation. Prime Minister David Cameron says his budget is going to help reduce the deficit. In the process, though, it's going to do something else as well. The government's role in everyday life is going to be getting smaller. Cameron calls his idea the Big Society, so we called up Marketplace's Stephen Beard and asked him how a political slogan might translate into practice.
This is the Big Society in action. The South London district of Sutton is giving away bags of grit or road salt for free.
Well, I've got some bags already done, so let me just carry these down for you.
Now, local residents like Christine Card won't have to wait for local government workers to come and salt the street in front of her house the next time it snows. She'll be able to do it for herself and for her neighbours.
We really struggled last year, and as I say, we've got quite a few elderly people down our way, and they couldn't even get in and out of the houses. So this is fantastic that we can be a bit more prepared this year, and hopefully it won't be as bad.
In Sutton Town Hall, the leader of the local council, Sean Brennan, proudly surveys a map of his fiefdom, and just as proudly reveals that so far he's given away more than 3,000 bags of road salt, all in what he says is a very good cause.
It's about the citizen having control over the decisions being made about their locality. It's about getting them involved in their community. It's about taking responsibility for their community.
And it's about saving money. His council can't afford to spread salt on every road in the district. Under the budget cuts, local authorities will lose more than a quarter of the money they get from central government over the next 4 years. Many taxpayer-funded local services will have to go. Sean Brennan sees this not as a setback, but an opportunity.
Now it's the individual stepping forward and the state stepping back. Small state, big individual, big society.
But not everyone in Sutton is taking up that new mantra.
Well, yeah, they said the big society when it was first announced. I said it was the big con.
Barry Todman is one of the area's most prolific volunteers. He now runs a group for seniors, and he takes a rather jaundiced view of the latest big idea, the Big Society.
It's an opportunity for them to divert public attention away from cuts and things like that.
And he says if the big society is just a fancy phrase for spending cuts, a way of getting volunteers to do the work of public servants, it will fail.
If, in fact, someone that is doing a paid job gets the sack and they want volunteers to do that job, I will not get involved. I don't think a lot of other people will either.
But the big society does have many enthusiastic supporters. This may not sound like the big society in action, but it is. It's a theatre group in North London called Only Connect. Set up by volunteers, it aims to help ex-convicts channel their energies into acting and to deter other troubled youngsters from a life of crime.
Mrs. Wilton?
Mrs. Ajemji?
Yes?
What do you want?
It's about your son.
It's about your son.
The man behind the group is also a guru of the big society movement. Danny Kruger says projects like his are now Britain's best chance of tackling chronic social ills like crime, poverty and drug addiction.
The big state, the large public sector, which has grown up over many decades in Britain, is no longer financially affordable, but it is also no longer effective at its main aim, which is to reduce poverty and fight social injustice.
Kruger says that local communities and motivated local residents are much better placed to combat their local social problems. But having lent so heavily on the state for so long, the big question for Britain as the state recedes is whether the big society will be big enough to fall back on. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, committed to customer choice and powering America's clean energy future through investments in nuclear, wind, solar, and efficiency technologies. By Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. And by Putnam Investments, focused on finding opportunities one stock at a time, on the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note as we leave you today about those gold prices everybody's been talking about the past couple of days, just, you know, in the interest of economic accuracy. $1,400 an ounce or so at the close today in New York is steep, no doubt about it. Not a record, though. Once you figure inflation into the equation, gold's still about 40% below its 1980 high. That's the real record, $2,318 an ounce. That is, of course, in today's dollars. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 60 points, about a half percent. The NASDAQ down 17 points, two-thirds of 1%. The S&P 500 fell 9 points, eight-tenths percent. Thanks to Ethan Lindsay, Sonata Lee, and Jolie Myers on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abeed, and that is where you ought to tune tomorrow morning for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time on this broadcast, why a lot of the Irish are trying to escape the Emerald Isle.
There was always that kind of dagger hanging over your head. You could be out of work, you know, within the next couple of weeks.
The dying days of the Celtic Tiger. I'm Kai Rizdal. I do hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.